A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about Syria after Assad, specifically what happens to the Alawites now that their guy is in Moscow. What's the relationship between Alawites, Druze, and the Sunni majority look like today? And with a tribal leader consolidating power and Israel sitting on the Syrian side of Mount Hermon, is there any place left for the Alawites? He's also asking whether Assad's fall triggered a wave of emigration and how the whole religious and tribal map of Syria is shifting. There's a lot to unpack here.
The Alawite question is probably the most uncomfortable piece of the post-Assad puzzle, and most coverage is dancing around it. You have somewhere between 1.5 and 2 million Alawites who were disproportionately tied to the regime, not just politically, but economically, socially, every layer of life, and now the regime is gone. The obvious question is whether they get a seat at the table, or whether they get collectively punished. And the answer so far is, it's messy.
Messy as in, we don't know yet. Or messy as in, people are already getting hurt.
There have been revenge killings in Latakia and Tartus. Those are the Alawite heartland provinces on the coast. Nothing on the scale of what people feared in the first weeks after the fall, but enough that Alawite communities are terrified. I saw a Reuters piece from March that documented at least a few dozen killings, mostly targeting former regime loyalists. But the line between regime loyalist and Alawite civilian gets blurry fast when you're talking about a community where nearly every family had someone in the security apparatus.
Because that was the bargain, right? The Assads built a system where Alawite loyalty was rewarded with jobs, patronage, protection. You didn't have to be a true believer. You just had to be in the network.
And that's what makes this so structurally difficult. It's not just that the Alawites were the ruling minority, it's that the entire economic architecture of the coastal region was built on state employment, military salaries, smuggling networks controlled by regime-connected families. When the regime collapsed, it didn't just take away political power, it took away the economic floor.
You've got a couple million people whose livelihoods vanished overnight, who are now associated with a brutal deposed regime, living in a country where the new leadership is Sunni and Islamist. That's not a recipe for peaceful integration.
No, and here's where it gets more interesting. The new guy, Ahmed al-Sharaa, formerly known as Abu Muhammad al-Julani, the HTS leader, he's been saying all the right things about inclusive governance. He met with Alawite community representatives in January. He's talked about a Syria for all Syrians. But HTS has an ideological core that spent years fighting a sectarian war against Alawite-dominated forces. The rank and file don't necessarily share the leadership's new tone.
We're all Syrians now is a great slogan. Trusting it with your family's safety is a different thing entirely.
That's exactly why we're seeing Alawite displacement. Not massive refugee flows crossing borders. Most borders are closed or heavily restricted. But internal displacement toward the coast, toward areas where Alawites are the majority and feel some safety in numbers. There was a Washington Post piece in February about villages in the mountains above Latakia that have doubled in population since December.
It's not emigration to other parts of the world, which is what the prompt was asking about. It's internal consolidation.
The big international emigration wave hasn't happened, partly because it can't. Europe is not opening its doors to Syrian refugees anymore. That era ended around 2016. Lebanon and Turkey already have millions of Syrians and aren't eager to take more. The Gulf states aren't welcoming Alawites, who they view as heretical or as regime remnants. So you get this internal compression. Alawites retreating to their historical strongholds, which creates a kind of de facto cantonization.
A rump Alawite statelet on the coast, just without the formal declaration.
And this is where the historical irony gets thick. The French Mandate period explicitly considered creating an Alawite state. It existed briefly in the 1920s. The idea has never fully died in the Alawite imagination, and now material conditions are pushing in that direction whether anyone declares it or not.
Let's talk about the Druze, because the prompt specifically asked about them. Where do they fit in this new map?
The Druze are fascinating because they've played both sides of every conflict in Syrian history and survived all of them. About 700,000 in Syria, concentrated in Ceuta in the south, with smaller communities near Damascus and in the northwest. During the civil war, the Druze mostly stayed neutral. They didn't rise up against Assad, but they also didn't enthusiastically fight for him. They ran their own affairs.
The Switzerland of Syrian minorities.
With one big complication, the Golan Druze. The ones in Israeli-controlled territory had spent decades navigating a completely different political reality. And in July of last year, we saw something unprecedented. Thousands of Druze from the Syrian side literally breached the border fence to reach family in the Golan. It was a pilgrimage, a reunion, and a political statement all at once. They were saying, "Our ties to our community across the line matter more than any border."
I remember that. The Israeli military basically stood back and let it happen.
And that moment said more about the future of the region than any diplomatic communique. Because what it demonstrated is that the Druze are a transnational community with their own interests, and they'll act on them regardless of what Damascus or Jerusalem says.
In today's Syria, where does that leave them? Are they aligning with the new government, keeping their distance, looking toward Israel?
All of the above, which is exactly what you'd expect from a community that has survived by never putting all its eggs in one basket. The Druze in Ceuta have been negotiating with al-Shirah's government. They want autonomy, they want their local militias to remain under Druze command, they want guarantees about religious freedom. Meanwhile, there's been quiet outreach from Israel to Druze communities near the border, offering humanitarian support, medical care, economic ties.
The new government in Damascus presumably sees that as a threat.
Of course they do. Any minority community that maintains independent armed forces and has a potential external patron is a challenge to central authority. But al-Shirah can't afford to crack down on the Druze right now. He's trying to consolidate control, get sanctions lifted, attract reconstruction money. Massacring a well-armed minority is bad for the international image.
Bad for the international image. The euphemism of the century.
But that's the logic these guys operate under. They need legitimacy, and legitimacy in 2026 means at least performing inclusion. The question is whether the performance eventually becomes reality, or whether it's a mask that drops once the cameras are off.
Let's talk about the Sunni majority. The prompt frames it as Alawites versus Druze versus Sunnis, but that's almost misleading. The Sunnis are something like 70% of the population. They're not one faction among many. They're the country.
Right, and this is what makes the Alawite question so existential. For 50-plus years, a minority that's maybe 12% of the population dominated the Sunni majority through a brutal security state. The Sunnis are not a monolith. You have urban merchant classes in Damascus and Aleppo, rural tribal networks in the east, Islamists, secularists, Kurds who are mostly Sunni but have their own national project. But the one thing that unites them is the experience of being ruled by the Assads.
The new government's legitimacy rests on delivering for Sunnis, which means there's zero political incentive to protect Alawites.
If al-Shirah is seen as too soft on Alawites, he opens himself to attack from more hardline Sunni factions who want retribution. There are armed groups that didn't join his coalition that think HTS sold out by going moderate. Every time he makes a conciliatory gesture toward Alawites, those guys gain recruits.
He's walking a tightrope between international legitimacy and domestic hardliners, and the Alawites are underneath the tightrope.
That's exactly the image. And here's the thing. The Alawites know this. They're not stupid. They understand that their safety depends on factors entirely outside their control, whether the new government can consolidate power before hardliners splinter it. Whether external powers like Turkey and the Gulf states push for inclusion or look the other way. Whether the economic situation improves enough that people care more about bread than revenge.
What about Russia? Assad is in Moscow. Is Russia doing anything for the Alawites they left behind?
Russia kept its naval base at Tartus and its air base at Kaimim. They negotiated that with the new government within weeks of Assad's fall. The Russians are pragmatists. They wanted to keep their Mediterranean foothold, and they were willing to abandon the Alawites to get it. There was a brief window where some Alawite communities hoped Russia would protect them or even back a coastal rub state, but Moscow made clear it wasn't interested in that fight.
The patron relationship was purely transactional. Once Assad wasn't useful anymore, neither were his people.
That's the brutal lesson of minority clientelism. You make yourself useful to a larger power, you get protection. The moment the calculus changes, you're on your own.
All right, let's get to the Israel piece, because the prompt asks about Israel's presence on the Syrian side of Mount Hermon, and that's a huge shift.
So for context, when Assad fell in December, the Syrian army essentially dissolved. Positions along the Golan border were abandoned. The 1974 disengagement agreement, the one that created the buffer zone after the Yom Kippur War, effectively collapsed because there was no Syrian military authority to maintain its side of the deal.
Israel moved in.
Israel moved in. And not just into the buffer zone, they pushed up to the summit of Mount Hermon on the Syrian side, which is strategically enormous. It overlooks Damascus. It overlooks southern Lebanon. It's one of the most valuable signals intelligence positions in the region. Israel now controls the entire Hermon Massif.
They've said this is temporary.
They've said it's temporary, but nobody expects them to leave anytime soon. The new Syrian government doesn't have the military capacity to force them out, and Israel's position is that they'll stay until there's a stable authority in Damascus that can guarantee security along the border. Given that stable authority in Damascus has been an oxymoron for the better part of 15 years, this could be a long-term occupation.
How does this affect the Alawites? They're on the coast. Hermon is in the south.
It's connected through the broader question of whether Syria remains a unified state or fractures into zones of influence. Israel on Hermon, Turkey in the north, the U.S. still embedded with the Kurds in the northeast. You've got external powers carving out spheres. If Syria becomes a patchwork, the Alawite coast becomes another patch. And the question is, whose patch?
Iran's not in the picture anymore.
Iran is out. That's one of the biggest strategic consequences of Assad's fall. The land bridge from Tehran through Baghdad and Damascus to Hezbollah in Lebanon is severed. Hezbollah is weakened. The entire Iranian project in the Levant has collapsed. And that actually makes the Alawites less relevant to regional powers. They were useful to Iran as a conduit, a friendly regime to host supply lines. Now that function is gone.
The Alawites have lost their strategic relevance to every major external player. Russia doesn't need them, Iran can't reach them, the West never cared about them, and the new government in Damascus views them as a problem to be managed.
That's the grim summary. And it's why I think the most likely medium-term outcome is de facto Alawite autonomy on the coast, not because anyone wants it, but because nobody has the will or capacity to integrate them into a unified Syrian state, and nobody has the will or capacity to ethnically cleanse them either. So you get this limbo.
The bureaucracy of a frozen war, just applied to an entire community.
And limbo is not a safe place to be. It's just safer than the alternatives.
Let's circle back to something the prompt asked about, how the religious and tribal demographic of Syria is actually changing. You mentioned internal displacement. Are we seeing permanent demographic shifts?
We are, and some of them are probably irreversible. The biggest story is the hollowing out of formerly mixed areas. Places like Homs, which used to be a mosaic, Sunni, Alawite, Christian, have been largely sorted. Alawites fled Homs during the civil war and never returned. The same pattern in Damascus suburbs in parts of Aleppo. The war functioned as a giant unmixing machine.
That's a polite word for ethnic cleansing.
It is, though it happened from multiple directions. Regime forces cleared Sunni neighborhoods. Rebel groups cleared Alawite villages. And in between, millions of people made the rational decision to move somewhere they'd be in the majority rather than risk being a vulnerable minority. The result is a Syria that is more demographically sorted than at any point in modern history.
That sorting makes partition more likely, not less. Once communities are physically separated, the political separation follows.
And the sorting isn't just Sunni versus Alawite. The Kurds in the northeast have their own administration, their own armed forces, their own oil revenues. The Druze in Sweden have been functionally autonomous for years. The Alawite coast is economically distinct, and now psychologically distinct. You have the raw materials for fragmentation.
What's holding it together?
One is the international consensus that Syria should remain a unified state, That's what the UN says, what the Arab League says, what Turkey and the Gulf states say publicly. The second is that none of the fragments are economically viable on their own. The Alawite coast has ports and some agriculture, but no real industrial base. The Kurdish northeast has oil, but is landlocked and surrounded by hostile powers. Damascus controls the institutions and the international legitimacy, but not much territory or revenue.
It's a failed state held together by the fact that breaking up would be even worse.
The Lebanese model, basically.
That's not a reassuring comparison.
It's really not. Lebanon shows you can have a state that technically exists, technically has borders and a flag and a seat at the UN, but in practice is a collection of sectarian fiefdoms that occasionally erupt into violence when the balance of power shifts. Syria could easily settle into that pattern for a generation.
Let's go back to the emigration question, because I think there's an interesting dynamic the prompt is getting at. When Assad fell, was there a wave of Alawites leaving Syria for good?
The short answer is no, not in large numbers, but the longer answer is more interesting. What we did see was the departure of the very top layer of the regime, senior officers, intelligence officials, the business elite who were personally implicated in war crimes or sanctions. Some went to Russia, some to the UAE, some to Lebanon. These were people who had the money and the passports to get out.
The Alawite equivalent of the Iraqi Ba'athist exodus after 2003.
Similar dynamic, smaller scale. But the mass of ordinary Alawites don't have that option. They don't have foreign passports. They don't have the savings to start over in another country. They're stuck. And stuck is a word that comes up a lot when you read interviews with Alawites in the coastal areas. There's a sense of being trapped between a hostile government in Damascus and closed borders everywhere else.
What about the ones who did get out during the civil war? There were hundreds of thousands of Syrian refugees, many of them Sunni, but there were Alawite refugees too.
Most of the Alawite refugees went to Lebanon, and their situation there was always precarious. Lebanon's sectarian system is already balanced on a knife edge and an influx of Alawites, who are a branch of Shia Islam, broadly speaking, complicated the Sunni-Shia Christian arithmetic. Many of those refugees have no path to permanent residency, no path to citizenship, and no realistic prospect of returning to Assyria where they'd be welcome.
You have a diaspora in limbo, and a homeland population in limbo. Not a lot of good options.
This is where I think the prompt's framing is really useful, because it's asking about the Alawites in relation to other groups. The Druze have a different set of options. They have a transnational identity. They have the Golan connection. They have a history of autonomy that gives them negotiating leverage. The Sunnis are the majority. They have numbers. They now have political power. The Kurds have territory, oil, and an American patron. The Alawites have none of that.
They have a coastline and a bad reputation.
The coastline only matters if someone wants to invest in it. Right now, Syria's economy is in ruins. I saw the World Bank estimated GDP contracted by more than half during the civil war, and reconstruction costs are somewhere north of $400 billion. Nobody's lining up to build luxury resorts on the Alawite coast.
They're sitting on potentially valuable real estate with no buyers.
Which is a metaphor for their whole situation, really. Potentially valuable, currently worthless, no buyers.
Let's talk about the tribal dimension, because the prompt mentions a tribal leader concentrating power. That's al-Sharara, but it's also the broader phenomenon of tribal politics in Syria.
This is undercovered. Syria has always had strong tribal structures, especially in the east, the Shamar, the Akkadat, other large Bedouin confederations. The Assad regime co-opted tribal leaders, played them against each other, used tribal militias as auxiliaries. Under the new order, tribal leaders are reasserting themselves as power brokers.
Al-Sharara is one of them? He's not a tribal leader in the traditional sense.
He's not from a major tribe, no. But he's operating in an environment where tribal legitimacy matters, and he's been cultivating tribal alliances. The key dynamic is that tribal identity often cross-cuts sectarian identity. There are Sunni tribes, but there are also tribes that include both Sunni and Alawite branches. In some areas, tribal solidarity has been a moderating force, tribal leaders intervening to prevent sectarian violence because it would split their own confederation.
That's a counterweight to the unmixing you were describing earlier.
It is, and it's one of the few sources of optimism in an otherwise bleak picture. Tribal structures are resilient in ways that state institutions aren't. They survived the Assads, they survived the civil war, and they'll probably survive whatever comes next. The question is whether they can be a bridge between communities or whether they get pulled into the sectarian logic like everything else.
Why does this leave us on the core question? Do Alawites have a place in today's Syria?
I think the honest answer is, they have a place, but it's not a good place, and it's not a secure place. They're tolerated rather than included. They're not being massacred, which is the low bar that many people feared they wouldn't clear. But they're also not being integrated into a new national project. They're being managed.
Managed toward what end?
That's the open question. If the new government succeeds in consolidating power and rebuilding institutions, there's a path toward gradual reintegration. Alawites as citizens of a reconstituted Syrian state, with legal equality if not social acceptance. If the government fails, if Syria fragments further, the Alawite coast becomes a de facto statelet, poor, isolated, and perpetually insecure.
If there's a backlash, if hardliners gain power and decide the Alawites need to be punished, we can see something much worse.
And the Alawites know that, which is why they're keeping their heads down and their guns close. There are still a lot of weapons in the coastal region. The new government has been trying to collect them, with limited success.
Nobody disarms when they think they might need to fight for their survival.
Basic logic of civil conflict. Disarmament only happens when there's trust, and there is no trust.
Let's pull back for a minute. The prompt asked about emigration, demographic change, the Druze, the Sunnis, Israel on Hermon. We've covered most of that. Is there anything we're missing?
I think the one thing we haven't touched on enough is the regional dimension. Syria doesn't exist in a vacuum. What happens to the Alawites depends partly on Turkey, partly on the Gulf states, partly on Israel, partly on what's left of Hezbollah in Lebanon.
Hezbollah is relevant here? I thought they were licking their wounds after the war with Israel.
They are, but Hezbollah has historical ties to some Alawite communities. The Assad regime was their lifeline for decades. There are Alawites who fought alongside Hezbollah, who have personal relationships with Hezbollah commanders. Hezbollah is weakened, but it's not gone, and it still has an interest in maintaining influence in Syria. That could mean providing protection to Alawite communities as a way of maintaining a foothold.
The Alawites might end up as clients of a diminished Hezbollah, which would make them even more of a pariah in the Sunni Arab world.
Which is exactly the kind of dynamic that perpetuates these conflicts. Every move to find protection deepens the isolation. It's a trap.
The structural trap of being a minority without a patron. Once your patron falls, you scramble for a new one, and the scrambling makes you look disloyal to whoever is in power, which makes you need a patron even more.
That's it. And the Druze have been better at this game. They've maintained multiple patron relationships simultaneously, they've kept their options open, they've never been fully dependent on any one power. The Alawites went all in on the Assads for 50 years, and now the bet has gone bad.
It's almost a cautionary tale about the risks of putting all your eggs in one basket. Except, it's not a tale. It's millions of actual people.
That's what makes this hard to discuss in purely analytical terms. We can talk about demographics and patronage networks and regional power dynamics, but underneath all of that are families trying to figure out whether they have a future in the place they've lived for generations. I think some do, and some don't. The ones who can credibly distance themselves from the regime. The ones who weren't in the security forces, who didn't benefit from the corruption, who can plausibly say they were just ordinary citizens. They have a chance. The ones who were deeply implicated, or who are perceived as deeply implicated whether or not they actually were, probably need to leave. And most of them can't.
We're going to see a slow sorting, not a sudden catastrophe. Alawites who can leave will leave. Alawites who can assimilate will assimilate, and the ones who can't do either will hunker down on the coast and wait.
Waiting is its own kind of catastrophe. It just happens in slow motion.
One last thing before we wrap. The prompt mentioned Israel's presence on the Syrian side of Hermon, and I want to connect that to the Alawite question in a way that's not obvious. Israel on Hermon changes the security calculus for everyone in Syria. It means Israel can see deep into Syrian territory, can strike anywhere it wants, and has demonstrated it will intervene if it perceives a threat. For the Alawites, that's actually a mixed bag. On one hand, Israel has no interest in protecting them. They're not the Druze. They don't have a constituency in Israel. On the other hand, Israeli military dominance constrains what the new government in Damascus can do. If Al-Sharad decided to launch a major military operation on the coast, Israel might see that as destabilizing and intervene.
That's an interesting point. Israel's red lines in Syria are still evolving, but they seem to include preventing any single faction from consolidating enough power to threaten the Golan. A campaign of ethnic cleansing on the coast probably wouldn't trigger an Israeli response, but a major military buildup there might.
The Alawites get a thin, accidental layer of protection from the fact that Israel wants Syria to remain fragmented and weak.
The enemy of my enemy is my transactional partner, as the saying goes. It's not a strategy, it's not a reliable defense, but it's not nothing.
In the world the Alawites are living in right now, not nothing is about as good as it gets.
That's a grim note to end on.
That's the topic. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1910s, the remote fishing communities of Tierra del Fuego, isolated on both sides of the Drake Passage, developed a unique set of maritime hand signals for communicating across howling winds and crashing waves. When steamships replaced sailing vessels after the First World War, the signals vanished within a single generation. No records, no dictionaries, no surviving practitioners. An entire language of the sea, erased by the very technology that made those waters safer to navigate.
A language killed by better boats.
The ghosts of Tierra del Fuego are gesturing at us, and we can't read it.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flemingtop. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com. If you want these in your ears the moment they drop, subscribe on Spotify. Herman, always a pleasure.
The pleasure is entirely mine. Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.